Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the show that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor.
And I'm John Perry.
We're coming to you from the studios of KALW Information Radio in San Francisco. But as always, in our minds, we picture ourselves sitting in a circle down at Philosopher's Corner in the Stanford campus.
Ken, what's our topic for today?
It's the meaning of life, John.
The meaning of life. The meaning of life. Does life have meaning? Does my life have meaning? Many people think that that's a religious question. And the answer is, if there's a God, that's what gives our life meaning, fitting into the purposes of this higher being.
Yeah, but people do think that way. But, you know, I wonder, where does God get his meaning, or its or her meaning? I never know what to call God, but where does it get its meaning from?
So you think that the fact that we were created by a being doesn't mean that our life should get meaning by reflecting his or her or its intentions in creating us?
It might, but that kind of makes us instruments in a way, you know, and I don't feel like an instrument. I feel like a thing unto myself, an end unto myself, as Kant would say. But, you know, the question actually kind of puzzles me. I'm not quite sure I know what the question is. People, when they think of philosophy, they often think, wait, what do philosophers study? Well, they talk about the meaning of life, but I really don't understand the question. Is it a question about all life, you know, the ultimate purpose of human life, period? Or is it a question for each individual about his or her life? I mean, help me.
So Ken, you're kind of doing our analytical philosopher type thing. Let's take a question, and instead of answering it, let's ask what the question means.
Well, that's a good avoidance technique.
Well, I mean, it can be an avoidance technique, but maybe it's worth indulging in for a little bit. Now, when we talk about meaning of something, of course, what's paradigmatically has meaning is words, and they have meaning because they point beyond themselves. They have significance. They stand for something. Is that what we want our lives to have? That fits in with a religious idea. If our lives are not just things that happen, but things that do or don't fit the intentions of God or the commandments of God, in that sense, they would point beyond themselves and have a meaning. Is that what people are after?
Well, that's one thing. I mean, you don't have to be religious to think that way, though. I mean, if you think Marx or Hegel, people who think there's this grand narrative of human history and it's going to culminate in some, you know, some glorious outcome, and we're all just kind of steps toward that. I mean, you know, you measure the meaning of your life, I guess, by the contribution you make toward the grand narrative of human history. I don't like that kind of story, though.
But conversely, it's negating that, denying that. That does seem to give some of us a sense of meaninglessness. We see the ideals for which we fight gather dust and don't have much importance. Then they tell us that the world's going to, you know, come to an end in just a few million years when the sun burns out, and probably human life will destroy it. Itself before then. That's all very depressing.
Does that
mean that life doesn't have meaning?
No, I don't know. I mean, but there's still the question. Even if you're right, even if there's no grand narrative, there's no God, there's still the question for each of us. We got to get up every day and we got to get through the day. And there's got to be something that gets you through the day. And each person has to answer that question. So maybe if there's no grand narrative, no God, there's still this question for each of us. How should I live?
Well, speaking of each of us, maybe we should get some sense of what people that aren't philosophers think they mean by the meaning of life.
And you know, our roving philosophical reporter, Amy Standen, did just that. She took to the street to ask everyday people about life's hidden meaning.
What is the meaning of life? It's the kind of question that can turn pretty much anyone into a philosopher. And just as there are different kinds of philosophy, the same is true for people. To begin with, the pragmatist.
Well, it's something that makes you happy, you know, that you enjoy doing. That's the basic thing.
The meaning of life is to try to do more good than harm, and I guess that's all.
It's too deep. The question's too deep. Sorry.
What'll help us figure it out?
Oh, God. Less Prozac? I don't know.
The metaphysicist.
I think the purpose is to keep questioning, you know, not to get into a comfort zone and to keep questioning what are we here for and what are we doing and where are we going?
The altruist.
I think for me it means giving back to the community.
Trying to help others and make others as happy and comfortable as can be.
Oh, I don't know, maybe give away some free books.
And what is the meaning of life to the amateur comedian?
Life, liberty, and the pursuit of George Bush as far as we can chase him.
But none of these really answer the question. We're an insignificant planet in an insignificant solar system. Does life, however you choose to live it, really matter?
No, I don't think it matters at all. I mean, it matters to us because we're people and, like, you want your kids to have a good, high quality of life. But there's no goal. There's no prize or anything more than what you get while you're here. And I think it's gone when you're gone.
Well, it matters to you. It matters to me. So whose other point of view are we going to check on? You can check on your own, right? I'm going to check on mine. So we're in agreement.
If that's the case, maybe this woman's on to something.
I mean, you can just be content. That's my goal, is contentment. If I can maintain a steady flow of contentment and a couple of happy peaks, I'm great.
On the streets of San Francisco, this is Amy Standen for Philosophy Talk.
Thanks, Amy. Now that we've heard some from some everyday folks, and Ken, I think some of those people had pretty good ideas.
Yeah,
myself.
Me too.
I'm not sure we can do better, but we do have an expert to bring on board.
That's our guest today is Professor Howard Wettstein. He can do better. Of the University of California at Riverside, Howie started his career aiming to be a rabbi, but applied his Talmudic skills to the philosophy of language, one of John and my great loves. He's the author of important books. The important books, Does Semantics Rest on the Mistake? The answer is yes, by the way. And The Magic Prism. More recently, his attention has shifted back to issues that are broadly religious in nature. These ideas are developed in his fascinating article, Against Theodicy and Doctrine. Howie, it's a pleasure to have you with us. Welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thanks very much. Pleasure to be here.
Hi, Howie. Welcome aboard.
Hi, John.
Now, tell us, I mean, what are people after when they worry about the meaning of life? Is it just indigestion, or is there a real substantive question here that philosophers can address?
That's
don't
for
know.
You, Howie. You don't know? Hey, you're the expert. You got to tell us, man.
Well, experts in philosophy are a dying breed.
Yeah.
I don't know. Let me tell a story about my own development in these ways. One of the things that was instrumental in my coming back to religion and after many years away was the death of my mother. And I remember reflecting at the time on the old cliche about there being no atheist in a foxhole and thinking to myself that at least in my case, and I think for lots of people, this doesn't have to do with what I saw as illusions, the idea that death is not real in some way, that person is really still with us. That wasn't real for me. What it had to do with was meaning. That doesn't answer the question. It just adds to it.
So, but meaning, yeah. What do you mean by meaning?
Yeah, well, tell us what you mean by meaning. I mean, what are you seeking for when you're seeking the meaning of life?
Yeah, so there's a movie called Bulletproof Heart. I don't know if you fellows have seen it.
Yeah, I haven't.
Anthony LaPaglia and Mimi Rogers. It's a terrific movie, I think.
I don't know how I missed that one.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think you were alone. But
I don't think you were alone, but I like it especially because it's about a hitman who's offered a prostitute as a reward for his good work, and then he's about to kill her just for fun, and he's reflecting on all this, and he's talking to a friend, and he says, I was thinking about it. What would it mean? It wouldn't mean anything if I did this. In a larger sense, it wouldn't mean anything. And then this thought was running around my head, what's the meaning of meaning? And then he says, when you get right down to it, I'm not sure anything means anything. And the other guy accuses him of going through male menopause.
Sounds probable. This is the kind of movie you go to now that you're in your religious phase.
Yeah,
I think so, right?
what kind of stuff did you enjoy when you were in your non-religious phase? I hate to think.
Let me try to say something a little bit more serious.
Okay.
I feel like the question, what is the meaning of life, is a conversation stopper. No one knows.
Well, we don't want to do that. No.
No one knows where to go with it. And that's, to some extent, I think I've experienced this in the philosophy of languages. Maybe you have as well. Questions about meaning are very hard to confront head on.
So look, let's turn it into a question that's not a conversation. Okay, so I think there must be something people are getting at when they ask themselves the question, what is the meaning of life? I mean,
surely.
So let's try and figure out some things they might be getting at. Let's grant that the question is problematic in some ways.
I mean, usually when we talk about meaning, don't we have in mind something has significance beyond itself? It fits into some larger pattern.
Right.
There's some sense of right and wrong, true or false, got it or don't got it. Is that, I mean, when you were thinking about the loss of your mother, and I gather you said you weren't thinking you wish there was an afterlife, but you hoped that life had meaning, that it wasn't just a meaningless event. Was that the kind of meaning you had in mind?
Yes. And in fact, I think it helps immediately to move to words like significance. It immediately helps to move to words like significance, whether it's how you further characterize significance is another issue, but certainly just making the move from meaning to significance helps for me. And significance shades off into importance. So in part the question is, does this have any importance, what I'm doing, what I am? So does it have any importance? Whether that's importance beyond itself or not, I don't know.
So Howard, clearly your mother's life had importance for you. All of our lives, unless we're really just hermits, have impact on others and have importance for others. Maybe they're glad we're dead. Maybe they're sorry we're dead. But everybody knows that. And so people still somehow feel that life would be meaningless if there were no God, or that life is meaningless if the universe has come to an end, they must not be satisfied with just the significance, the meaning their life has for the life of others. Is that seem correct? I mean,
I guess it does.
So why should people want to have meaning beyond the meaning we have in the life of others?
Well, look, John, let me try. I'm not quite sure. Suppose if there is a God, and God is a providential, loving God, and has a plan for the universe.
Boy, you're in an optimistic mood.
I know. Just suppose, though. And then you are part of this great thing. Then your life is a part of something ultimately good, ultimately, you know, rational or whatever. You know, it's founded on divine love and divine providence and divine wisdom. So you're a big deal because you contribute to this plan. And so you take your life seriously, not just as a thing that has importance to you, but as has importance to the universe, to the very nature of being or something like that. I mean, that's a nice thing.
I mean, it's not just lives that we use the phrase meaning for. We talk about meaningless jobs, and a meaningless job is one that doesn't seem to really be contributing anything to the company that hires you or something like that. So, what do you think, Howie? Is that the same sense of meaning? Suppose you're an ant. Didn't you have an anthill story you used to tell me about the meaning of life? Tell us your anthill story, Howie.
My anthill story is this. I used to teach at Notre Dame, and it was
Is that where you became an atheist?
I think so. Anyway. Actually, I spoke afterwards to one of the people there, and I said, you know, it's only since leaving Notre Dame that I got interested in religion, and this person said, that's not an accident.
Well.
So there was a fellow who was a doctor, a physician from UC Davis, who came to study Christian philosophy at Notre Dame, and he and I used to talk a lot because I was the village atheist, and it was a lot of fun to talk to this fellow. And at one point he looked at an anthill, and he said, if not for God, my life would be as meaningless as that. And I looked at the ants and I thought, they look less depressed than most philosophers I know.
Yeah, right.
So it didn't seem to me a paradigm of meaninglessness at all. And then it occurred to me that a person could believe in God in lots of ways, say the kind of conception Ken just articulated, and if the person was not in the right place, still feel that it's all dark and insignificant and meaningless. Job wrestled with such thoughts, certainly. A person could be an atheist and be in the right place, that is, to be engaged with life, to have significant projects, to have significant relationships, and feel that life was filled with meaning.
Yeah.
So it doesn't seem like simply... It raises the question of how religion is supposed to help here, which is not to say it doesn't help.
Yeah. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today we're talking about the meaning of life with Professor Howie Wettstein of the University of California at Riverside.
We'd like to hear what you have to say. Give us a call at 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or go to our website, www.philosophytalk.org, and send us a comment.
Does life have a meaning? If so, what gives it a meaning? Is that a biological question, a religious question, an ethical question, or a stupid and pointless question? Philosophy Talk will be right back.
If that's all there is.
Peggy Lee, and Is That All There Is? No, actually, we still have another minute. We still have another 40 minutes or so of Philosophy Talk to go. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Today we're discussing the meaning of life with Professor Howard Wettstein of the University of California at Riverside. For this to be a true dialogue, we need your input, so you can call us by dialing 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. 4134.
Does life have a meaning? If so, what gives it meaning? A biological question? Religious question? Ethical question? Stupid and pointless question. How do you decide how to live your life?
Yeah, let us know what you think. Again, that's 415-841-4134. Howie, going back to what you were saying before the break, that religion doesn't really help, because even if you believed all this religious stuff, you could be in two different places. You could be depressed and think it's pointless, or you could be optimistic and upbeat, and so the question of religion just doesn't settle it. Help me think about that some more. I found that fascinating.
Let me go back to something you raised in connection with this. You raised the question at one point, I believe you did, Ken, about who gave God's existence meaning.
Yeah, I did.
Right. And reflecting on that, the first thing that strikes me is that the fact that it's allegedly eternal, that it lasts forever, doesn't answer the question. Because if it's not meaningful now, then extending it over time doesn't really help. And it seems very interesting that God's creation of people suggests, certain passages in the Bible actually suggest, that perhaps he needs creatures that in some ways are like him. He needs them to love them and to bestow gifts on them and to follow out this kind of line. God has projects which he shares with these people when they're not going well, as so often in the Bible. He gets depressed.
Right?
And you may think this is a bold idea perhaps, but perhaps his own sense of meaning is threatened.
Yeah.
Well, so if you have kind of an Old Testament God, I don't want to impinge on theologians here, but it's a God that strikes one as finite, not knowing what's going to happen exactly, full of emotions, and who creates us to love him. It says that somewhere, I think. That if that is enough to give our life meaning, then it seems like other people should be enough to give our life meaning. I mean, if it gives our life meaning to give this finite, powerful old curmudgeon someone to love, then why isn't just having children and parents and relatives and co-hosts on Philosophy Talk to love, or at any rate tolerate, enough to give our life meaning?
Well, John, that's really great. If a needy God is enough, why isn't a needy friend or a needy lover or a needy child? What do you think?
Seems like it is, actually. That is to say, if your life is filled with purposeful activity, if you have projects, if you have shared projects with your family, and if your family is one of your projects, you can go for quite a long stretch without any threat to meaning.
Yeah.
Right? Meaning gets threatened, though, by various things, by perceptions of the finitude of the whole thing, by the loss of significant people in it, by the projects going badly. And then when it's threatened, it seems that religion helps a lot. And the question is, how does it help? Well, one way it helps is the kind of thing Marx put his finger on by talking about opiate, about religion as an opiate, right? Religion will tell you sometimes that it's only an illusion that there's evil, or there's only an illusion that the projects are going badly somehow. In the larger sense, they're not, or that it's only an illusion that life ends. This is not the side of religion that's tremendously powerful for me in this way.
I agree with you, and I want to take that point further. See, and it's not just religion; it's also Marx and Mao and Stalin and Hitler. What I mean by that is there are these thinkers and there are these views that come at us with sort of totalizing views about what human life is for. The totality of human history is just culminating in this or that, or, you know, God's divine wisdom, or the capitalist, the overcoming of capitalism, or whatever, the coming of reason in Hegel. I just think all those things are deeply oppressive. Forget about all that stuff and go back to, how do I get through the day? With whom do I get through the day? What guides my choices here and now? That's the kind of question I think makes more sense myself.
And it's not only how you get through the day, but how you get through the day with a sense that it matters, right? One of the people who called in spoke about being content. And this is a topic my wife and I argue about all the time, because she's a content advocate. And I think it's not about contentment. There's a famous Talmudic remark that a rich person is one who – it's often translated as a rich person is one who's content with his lot. And I always point out that the word isn't content, it's joyous.
Yeah.
So it's not just a matter of getting through the day. It's getting through the day with a sense of it matters.
That's a very nice point, Howie. Pierrette in Cola Madera is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Pierrette. Did I get that right?
Pierrette, yes.
Yes. What's your comment or question?
I want to talk about the importance, perhaps, of confronting the meaninglessness of life. I mean, if you've ever gotten to that Zen moment where you actually see the meaninglessness and get to the other side, that it doesn't mean anything, that it doesn't mean anything, there's a kind of presence that makes itself available. I'm reminded of the E.E. Cummings poem that begins, "What got him was nothing." You know, if you've ever passed through that area of nothingness or meaninglessness, there is something available on the other side that's a quenching sort of experience.
That's a nice point, Perrette. Thank you very much. That reminds me of your favorite song, John. Nothing, nothing, nothing.
Yes, this anthem to nihilism by the Fugs that I keep telling our producers we ought to play someday. Howie, the Zen perspective that we've just heard, that you know, kind of the, on the underside of meaninglessness is the meaning of meaninglessness. I that kind of appeals to me, but I think about cases of people who are really suffering, and I'm not sure that kind of approach really helps. You and I have talked a lot in the past about the Holocaust, and I know you've thought deeply about it. And the paradox of the stories we see there is this incredible suffering that suggests kind of a first-hand experience with what Ken was talking about, all the evil that seems to subside in the universe, somehow made a lot of people more religious. How does that figure? There's a conversation stopper.
Yeah. I just need a second when you say that to pause and think about it. It's such a good question. One of the things I show my classes often is a movie, a post-Holocaust movie called The Quarrel. Small Canadian, low-budget movie. People don't know about it. It's a wonderful movie.
It is a wonderful movie. That one I have seen.
I showed it to your class, I think, and it was a great a great experience. It's about two guys who studied in the yeshiva together pre-war, and then the Holocaust happened, and each of them thinks that everyone they know is dead. They had a major quarrel before the war because one left religion, and that caused cataclysm. And then they meet in a park in Montreal, and they argue for a couple hours about the meaning of life. And there's lots of things about this movie are very striking. One of them is that the man who stayed and got more religious has a seems happier and better off in all sorts of ways. And showing this to lots of different groups, it's just very interesting, the reactions. I don't know. So let me jump to my sense of, try to answer your question specifically with regard to the caller. Is the threat to meaning, for me at least, somehow moves me closer in to God.
Mm-hmm. Howard, go ahead.
No, and I'm just going to say that's because the role God plays for me is not one who promises that it's all going to be great. That's not how I experience it. The role it plays for me is a kind of a cosmic partner, that we're involved in this project of making the world better and suffering together through the way it isn't so good. And in the way that when a couple, say, loses a child, it can destroy them or it can bring them closer together.
Yeah,
Howard. In that movie, one of the guys, the fellow who fell away from God, says, or somebody says, maybe it was you that said it, that a Jewish atheist is just someone who's really angry at God, and
right.
Whoever said it, that fit his persona. He hadn't totally fallen away. What gave his life meaning was this bitterness at right. God, and you know, as someone who doesn't believe most of the time. I kind of envy that. I'd like some cosmic figure to be really angry at.
Here's a cosmic figure. That's me. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking with Professor Howie Wettstein of the University of California at Riverside about the meaning of life. You can join our conversation by calling 415-841-4134, and we have callers on the line. Next up is Heather in San Francisco. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Heather.
Hi, thanks.
So what's your question?
Thanks for the accessible discussion. As I live in Northern California, most of the people I know are either hedonists or altruists, I think. Each of them, you know, either doing things because they feel good or because they want to help others. But the reason that people I know seem to be pursuing the meaning of life is for the stuff they don't want to do. And someone there talked about the death of his mother. You know, death, Holocaust, things that hurt, or just stuff you don't want to do. Somehow people need to explain that to themselves.
Yeah. Thank you, Heather. I mean, there is stuff you want to explain to you. I mean, Holly, you're talking about God as a partner in this cosmic endeavor. I mean, you know, you want to believe that there's somebody on the other side helping you out, thinking through this with you. I mean, that seems to me to make sense. But
right. I think that's, to respond to the woman who just called, I think that's because there were these threats to meaning. That we don't need to have a well-developed, rich sense of the meaning of life all the time. We don't need it for it to be right before our eyes if we're involved with our projects and relationships. But things threaten them.
Yeah.
And that's when it happens.
But let me jump in here. I mean, I agree. There are these threats to meaning. And I think that's partly because human beings just crave. You said something about we want to get through the day believing that what we've done is important. It's not just how we get to the day, but how we get through the day with a sense that what we've done matters. And matters to whom? Well, matters to ourselves, matters to the people we care about, whose opinions we respect, whose concern we crave. But, you know, I don't buy your idea about a cosmic partner. I just don't buy it. I mean, it's us. You know, the question has urgency because there isn't a cosmic partner, because it falls entirely on us to make a world that's comfortable for us, that feels like home. You know, I agree with Marx, religion and all those, and not just that, but all those totalizing fantasies are just opiate. Even Marx is an opiate,
but,
I think.
But Howard's God, the one who wants to be a partner in making things better, that seems, again, to fit sort of with the Old Testament God. It doesn't seem to fit to me. With all due respect to my some of my best friends are Christians, you know, to the kind of the official middle-aged Christian God that's perfect in every way and maybe not even in space and time. What help does he need from me? And if he screwed things up, what what can I do about it?
Wait a minute, so you don't mean middle-aged.
How cosmic is your cosmic partner?
Me?
Yeah.
Your cosmic partner. You're the one who wanted him.
Is he this all-perfect being, which, by the way, the Jewish theologians went for, too, or is he just more an Old Testament curmudgeon that you hope is keeping an eye on things and helping you occasionally?
I'm not sure about curmudgeon.
well, I mean, don't piss him off.
I create God in my own image, and I'm a curmudgeon, so.
There's a poem I teach the students called Guardian Angel by a contemporary poet named Stephen Dunn. I recommend it very highly. It's about an angel who gets depressed at how hard it is to help anybody and how it doesn't really seem to make any difference. And people find the poem very powerful. And then I ask them, do you think the poet believes in a guardian angel for this to have the power it has for us? So I don't speak for anybody else now, but myself, my own feeling about it is that I'm not talking metaphysics when I'm talking about a cosmic partner. I'm talking about a kind of poetry in a way.
Right.
That might seem to be a very reductive kind of idea, and that to rob religion of its heart. That's a long story.
No, it doesn't. It seems to me to make religion a practical matter. It seems to me kind of Kantian, not a matter of deep metaphysics, but how we shall view ourselves as living in the world. But we have a lineup of callers in the line. Albert in San Francisco. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Albert.
Hi. If you'll let me for a moment be the voice of religious orthodoxy, I'd like to say that I think that the sort of Marxist conception of religion as opiate is very much about the sort of Platonic, some would call heretical strain of Christianity, which, Orthodox theologians might call heretical, which sort of states that the goal of Christianity is kind of just getting to the next world or something. But the message that's very much found in both the New and the Old Testament is this world kind of message. It's very much about social change and betterment. And I think that it's that kind of seeking for the good, you know, as Plato might say, whether that's bettering life through moral action or through finding truth, that Kant was talking about in his concept of duty, and that even maybe Schopenhauer was talking about in his sort of denial of the self. And I think it's that questing for the good, which gives life meaning.
Albert, thanks a lot. I think you have a good point. There's no doubt about it. There's certainly that strand in Orthodox Christianity. But I have to say to you that okay, God wants us to perfect this world, but why is it so screwed up? Why do all these people perish? Think of the roughly 106 billion, by somebody's best estimate, Homo sapiens who have lived on this planet, and ask how many of them have lived lives of full flourishing. I bet you not a very small percentage. They've been exploited labor, they've been slaves, they've been killed in pointless wars, they've been feudal slave, you know, all kinds of bad things have happened to this 106 billion
people. I can't loosen up. I mean,
no, I'm serious.
Lighten up.
Yeah. No, I mean, certainly. Why, you've got a
God that made that, you know, and said, now perfect this. I say to that God, jeepers, why'd you make it so hard?
Well, would you say it to him face to face? That's my question.
Yeah, right.
Let me throw a piece of email in the mix here because it's a somewhat different perspective than our caller, but something a little close to what Howard has said. This is from Stephen in Youngsville, North Carolina. Glad that people are listening to us in Youngsville, North Carolina. I believe humans must live their lives as if life had meaning. Nietzsche told us that we can put up with any what as long as we have a why. The fact that meaning is something that we bring to the party is irrelevant. I like that, Stephen. What do you think, Howie?
Yeah, I love it. It seems to me we're inveterate meaning makers, and that's what we're talking about in a way.
Yeah.
We need for it to be significant, and we can find, I mean, I don't know. I feel like going back to the thought that significance is not threatened by lots of when it's going well, and when significance is threatened, we need to ask the question about what we can do to make it better. And then we were drawn to religion, and then drawn in philosophy to the question of what meaning is, and it's very confusing.
But Howard, just going back to what you said a minute ago, it sounds to me, to my cynical self, like your conversion is kind of a half conversion. You decided that you want a God in your life, that you want a cosmic partner. That you need a cosmic partner, but you didn't quite decide that there really is one. So you decided it's okay to invent one. That's what it sounded like to me. Is that a little unfair to your religiosity at this point?
I think so. but notice how I say it. I think so.
On that point, I'll say we're joined. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're joined by Professor Howie Westine of the University of California at Riverside. We'd like you to join our discussion on this deep topic, you know, the meaning of life. You can give us a call at 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. The questions we've been asking ourselves: does life have a meaning? If so, what gives it meaning? What kind of question is this anyway? A religious question, an ethical question, a stupid, pointless, misguided question? Join us after this short break.
The Tubes and What Do You Want From Life? If what you want is more juicy discussion on the meaning of life, you've come to the right place. I'm John Perry, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything
except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. Here to help us ponder the meaning of life is Professor Howie Westine of the University of California at Riverside. Howie, John, before the break, accused you of some kind
yes.
of deep hypocrisy. I want to give you a chance to come back at him, but I want to ask,
right.
I want to twist the knife a little bit more. Because, okay, you don't really believe in this cosmic partner. So I'm wondering, like John, why posit it? Why not just say, and you said we're inveterate meaning creators or mongers, or I can't remember your exact phrase. But, yeah, we do. We monger for meaning, and we look for partners. And they're all around us, our fellow human beings, you know, our friends, our society, our nation. Why not just rest there? Why go to this divine partner? Since, especially, you don't really believe in it.
Look, as President Nixon used to say, I'm happy you asked that question.
Okay, good.
So first, with respect to what John raised, it's a great question. I believe there's real truth here. I have a friend who is very upset that I returned to religion since he rejected it, and we argue about this all the time. And at one point I said to him, the problem is you're looking for physics truth, and the kind of truth that's here is Mozart truth. That doesn't clarify anything for a philosopher because we want to think a lot about those concepts. But there's something there. That is to say, you know, it may be that every sentence in various parts of the Bible is false. I mean, there may be novels that get at very deep truths about the human condition and the universe, yet express it by sentences that are not literally correct.
Well, your idea of Mozart suggests I mean, I kind of like this idea. Mm-hmm. Music doesn't even kind of claim to have a literal meaning most of the time, and yet we do have a sense that some music is right on, and some of it isn't.
That it makes contact with something deep about the universe or the human condition. That's what I feel about this. So when Ken says, you don't really believe in it, that would require a very long discussion, because I think the concept of belief is ill-suited to this domain. I mean, it's more straightforward when it comes to weather reports and history, facts about what went on. When it comes to this domain that values and facts are mushed together in kind of very complicated ways, belief doesn't seem to me the most helpful idea. So just to give you an example, take the idea in the Bible that people reflect God's image. Now, that's very powerful, but who knows exactly what it means, that if you try to find a kind of literal paraphrase, it's very, very difficult. And yet we can describe someone as believing it deeply, but belief in such a context doesn't mean, you know, you think this propositional content, to use the jargon, is true. It's quite complicated. So
yeah,
religious belief is a topic that really needs a lot of work.
I understand. We have callers in line. Let's see what they have to say about belief and other matters. John in San Francisco is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, John.
Well, thank you for this program. I hope you have another one on the same subject soon. I was in listening to you. I think that the meaning of life can be looked at it two ways. If you're looking for meaning in life and it's like a scientific endeavor, then you're not going to find anything there. But if you look at meaning as something that you give it, for example, if you have a photograph of your grandmother who was very good to you, the photograph has a lot of meaning and stirs a lot of emotion in you, and show it to somebody else, it has no meaning to them at all. So I think in that sense we give religion and life meaning because we give it to it. But if we actually look at it and try to discover some meaning in it, I don't think there is any.
Yeah, thanks, John. I think that's a nice point. I mean, you're saying in some ways there's no intrinsic meaning or something like that, but we can endow it with meaning.
I have a third thought here. Instead of just seeing it as a question, I like that question a lot, but instead of just seeing it as a question of whether, as a scientific endeavor, we discover its meaning as if life had a meaning which is available if you think hard enough, we don't like that idea. The other alternative being we give it meaning, and some of what I said before suggested that about inveterate meaning makers. A third possibility, though, is that it's more like art, like the arts. That is to say, it's not exactly we can say what this work of art means, but it's not exactly that we just give it meanings, right? We respond to it in certain ways, and meaning seems to be the outcome.
Well, we've got an email along the same lines. This is from John over in Alameda. Quote, just as words have meaning only in the context of other words, so life has meaning in a relative sense. That is, it has meaning to the extent that we can relate our lives to other life. As individual life may very well have no meaning when taken out of context, and individual life may very well have no meaning taken out of context. I mean, a related point is if we think about meaning in the case of language, words don't have any intrinsic meaning. They're just sounds or marks. We give them meaning by the use we make of them. Does it make sense to say that our lives have meaning by the use we make of them, or does it have to be someone else or something else that's making use of them?
Holly, what do you think?
Well, like probably what Ken said before, the idea that God would have purposes and that itself gives meaning to my life doesn't appeal to me much. Right, that the life has to have a kind of meaning, in part to me, and in part a significance that goes beyond me. So that's not a straightforward answer, but there it is.
Yeah,
well, Kant had this idea that you know it was wrong to treat other people only as a means; that sometimes you had to take into account their ends. So maybe God, the idea, what makes the idea of God appealing is that He didn't just create us as means, as instruments. But He also created us as Kant would say, ends in ourselves, that is, people that have desires and so forth. Well, and so I'm getting pretty philosophical here, but this is philosophy.
Well, that's certainly true. That's a Christian vision of God's creation. I mean, the way in which we're supposed to resemble God is the freedom of our will, the absolute power of our of choice. And so to set our own ends, and sin is when we set our ends in contrary to God's ends, but we have that power. He gave us that power out of, you know, divine love. So, I mean, we're not just tools. I mean, and there's the Christian theology doesn't say we're just tools of God.
So you spent some time at Notre Dame too, and you seem to have absorbed a lot of the Christian doctrine.
Yeah, I did. let's take some callers in the here. I think Paul in San Rafael is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Paul.
Thank you very much. This topic's actually one of my favorites. What I always thought was that the meaning of life is relationships, and it starts out with the relationship that you have with yourself, and then the relationship you have with some type of spiritual entity, and then the relationship that you have with your fellow human beings, your family, your immediate family, and your extended family, which is the whole human race. But it really goes to the relationship that you have with the earth, because if you want to believe that this earth was created and some spiritual entity created it, then everything that was created has meaning and is spiritual. So if you respect that and respect all life, not just that you're here as the controller of all life, but you respect all life and try and seek its purpose, then it's like a farmer making soil from compost and then creating with that soil growing plants, and then that plant becomes compost again. It's a continuous cycle. With that respect, that is the meaning of life.
Paul, that's a nice, optimistic, all-encompassing vision. You know, I'm kind of a curmudgeon. John, you have a...
You're a curmudgeon. I'm the curmudgeon around here.
Yeah, but about this question, I'm a super curmudgeon.
Here's Marcia's email, and it makes a similar point. Very effectively, I observe the geranium outside my window. It is alive. Its purpose is to be a geranium, to grow and reproduce successfully. It can then die fulfilled. I also am alive. I happen to have reproduced successfully, and I'm now dying. But like the geranium, I can enjoy the sun and do until my time is up. I happen to find that enough. I must say, in my grandfatherly moments, I get these feelings that, you know, it's you're part of the cycle from humus to humus or compost to compost. In my philosophy authoring moments, I don't like that. I want my books to just... live there forever on the shelf with my name and being occasionally read by people who are very careful in how they turn the pages.
But it can't be enough. The compost idea can't be enough. Because, again, I know you don't. I don't want to sound like... Go back to the 109 billion human beings. Go back to
that. You don't want to sound like a broken record?
I don't want to sound like a broken record, but go back to the 109 billion human beings. And think of how many have perished at the hands of tyrants, enslavers, murderers. Just think of how many have lived in abject poverty. They're part of the passage from compost to compost, but that's not enough, right? I mean, just to be here and be part of the passage is not enough. Would you agree with that, Howie?
Yeah, this question of what's the point of life is the Woody Allen joke that unless you've suffered, you missed the point.
Yeah, right.
Right. I'm really suspicious of anybody who has a story to tell about this is the meaning of life or that's the point. One of the arch medieval theologians who is off on the wrong track with respect to what John and I were talking about before, about, you know, the basic picture of God in the Old Testament as opposed to the way the medieval philosophers constructed it. Maimonides is one of the arch philosophers, but what he says is that the usual story that we were put here, that the universe was created for us and that we were put here to serve God and that it's all one, it's a kind of linear story, he says this doesn't make any sense because why did God need it if he's so perfect and so on? So he throws his hand up about answering the question about what's the point. So those kinds of thoughts don't really do it for me. When I think about how religion helps, and this connects to what John just said, it enlarges my moral horizons in a way. It puts what happens in a larger perspective. It gets me to think about in a bigger and larger way. So that in some sense, I'm very important, and at the same time, I'm a small piece of something that's very large.
We got time for one last caller. Kieran in San Francisco's on the line. Did I get that right, Kieran?
Yes, you did. Very, very impressive.
Okay. What's your comment or question?
Yeah, just a quick comment, really. I was just kind of thinking on what people were saying, and it occurred to me that a lot of meaning seems to be temporal in the sense that, you know, at a particular moment in time, things will be meaningful to us. But we all know that as you go through life, what's meaningful to you at one point in life is usually not meaningful to you at another point in life. So it just seems to suggest that we're imposing meaning on things rather than them having intrinsic meaning of their own.
Well, thanks. That's a nice observation, Kieran. Thanks for your call. Howie, you got one last comment to that before you say goodbye to you?
One of the things that's so striking about all of this is how hard it is. That is to say, I teach philosophy of religion a lot lately, and people want answers. And one of the things that philosophy does for people is to show them how to think effectively about smaller questions and clarify things along the way, but also to show how major these questions are, and they're not things for quick answers.
Well, that's certainly true, and we haven't had any quick answers here, but I hope we've given our audience some food for thought. We'd like to thank you, Howie, for being our guest on Philosophy Talk. We've been talking with Howie Wettstein from University of California at Riverside. He's the author of, among other things, Against Theodicy and Doctrine. Howie, it's been a pleasure having you with us.
Thanks so much.
Thanks, Howie.
So, John, what did you learn today about the meaning of life?
Well, I think it would be interesting if we had time to replay Amy Standen's piece and see what the different positions that the people she talked to took and compare them to the various positions we've tried out. I think you'd see that philosophy isn't something just radically different from what ordinary people think. It's a deepening and lengthening and, I suppose, sometimes trivializing of thoughts that we all have. That's why we think it's so much fun to do.
Yeah, that's right. I think you're right about that. I mean, my pearl of wisdom today, I guess, I love that phrase that Howie used about the inveterate makers of meaning. I think that's really right. We make meaning. I'm sometimes puzzled by the desire to see it come from someplace else, the universe, God, or something. I don't understand that part.
Well, today we will give the final word on our subject to the 60-second philosopher Ian Scholes.
Ian has assembled a little cross-section of philosophical thought on the subject, and it goes like this.
Ian Scholes, okay, so what is the meaning of life? The existentialists say it has no meaning, and Ludwig Wittgenstein says it's a meaningless question. Darwinians say that the purpose of life is to create more life. Ask it another way. What kind of life is worth living? Can I find satisfaction in my life? For Buddhists, satisfaction is the release from the suffering caused by our desires and needs. For Arthur Schopenhauer, life is our desires and needs, and since we're only human, life is irrational and painful. He lived to a ripe old age. Nietzsche, who read Schopenhauer, thought that life is only worth living which develops the strength to withstand the sufferings of existence. We must not lapse into the will to nothingness or nihilism. Anarchist Mikhail Bakunin, on the other hand, had nothing but good things to say about nihilism. Quote, let us put our trust in the eternal spirit which destroys and annihilates only because it is the unsearchable and eternally creative source of all life. The passion for destruction is also a creative passion, unquote. The nihilist meaning of life, you break it, it's yours. The Christian tradition, of course, begs the question of the meaning of life by positing the existence of God. Aquinas, for example, believed we should live according to God's laws in order to achieve heavenly paradise, a delayed happiness. Many reasons for living revolve around the proper way to live. Look at the ancient Greeks. A forerunner of the nihilists, skeptics denied even the possibility of certainty, which made life a breeze if you think about it. Don't worry, be uncertain. As a school of thought, skeptics didn't last very long and exist today as those folks who go around debunking astrology and mind readers. As good a reason to live as any, I guess. The hedonist Greek Epicurus believed that the greatest good in life was to seek pleasure. Centuries later, Jeremy Bentham expanded this into utilitarianism. The greatest good is whatever brings the greatest happiness to the greatest number. One of his followers, John Stuart Mill, later noted, however, that not all pleasures are equal, saying, quote, it is better to be Socrates unsatisfied than a pig satisfied, unquote. Maybe the purpose of life is to forego pleasure. The cynics believe that living a virtuous life according to nature is necessary and sufficient for attaining happiness. They disdained wealth and social status. Then came the Stoics, who practiced indifference to the physical world. Pleasure, pain, sickness, health, all were unimportant. They believed in a kind of enlightenment through apathy. Finally, Douglas Adams, in The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, has an advanced race of beings build a computer to find the answer to life, the universe, everything. After 7 million years, the computer spits out the meaning of life. The answer? 42. Works for me. I gotta go.
Thanks, Ian. If you'd like to add your philosophy on the meaning of life to these Ian just mentioned, head to www.philosophytalk.org. You can join our online forum, join our ever-growing community of thinkers.
We'd also be happy to address any philosophical issues you're dealing with in your own life. To do so, send an email to conundrums@philosophytalk.org or go to our website and click on the Conundrums button.
And join us next week when John and I discuss the legalization of drugs with Professor Peter DeMarnef of Arizona State University.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2004.
And our overseer, executive producer, that's Gordon Earle.
Special thanks go to Nicole Sawaya, Roman Mars, and Alan Farley of KALW.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from the Hoover Institution, the Greenwald Foundation, and the Pacific Division of the American Philosophical Association.
Also from various groups at Stanford University, from the Friends of Philosophy Talk, from members of KALW, 91.7 Information Radio for San Francisco, where our program originates.
And we thank them one and all. The views expressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our funders, and they certainly don't add up to an answer to the meaning of life.
The conversation continues on our website, www.philosophytalk.org. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're so glad you lent us your ear.
Yes, thanks for listening and thanks for thinking.